My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about institutional decline. Hi, Balder. This comes almost exactly 3 years after we recorded an episode on the hollowing out of institutions. What has changed since then? Why are we talking about the decline and no longer the hollowing out?
Hi, Dario. Well, yes, this is actually quite interesting because this was one of our key episodes at the time that kind of encapsulated our concerns about what was going on with the West. And what you're seeing now is that hollowing out of institutions is in now turning into basically the collapse of institutions, right? At the time and over the past 10, 15 years, there's a very, very clear dynamic where international organizations set up by the West, but also internally, governmental structures are all slowly eroding and turning away from their liberal democratic model. And in 2025, not just because of Donald Trump, but of course Trump hasn't helped, you see that these institutions that were so carefully set up for the past 80 years are in a free fall and people don't care about them anymore. And the West is acting as if they were never really that necessary. And that is fascinating, but also very scary to observe because we don't have a plan B, right? We don't know what's coming next.
At this moment, to me, it feels important to once again stress that Donald Trump is not the root cause of all of this, right? But it is the Western bubble. It is the root cause. And Trump is a symptom. I'm not sure if I'm still calling him a symptom. So I think 3 years ago, I was very much sure that he's a symptom. I think now he's an accelerator of it, right? So he's a symptom, but he's doing it at a much faster pace than we have seen before, just because he has zero moral convictions, zero ideology that you could work with.
Well, yeah, in LinkedIn lunatics terms, you could call him a disruptor, right? That's what all those business schools like, disruption, which I've never understood, or, you know, just celebrating change for the sake of change. He is clearly someone who is accelerating this freefall. But he comes, in that sense, he is still a symptom. He comes out of a world that no longer believes in their Western ideals and liberal democratic principles, right? So he is still very much the outcome of this decline of Western thinking. And now that outcome is basically starting to pull the cards, so to speak.
So 3 years ago in the episode, The Hollowing Out of Institutions, that was episode 3 for the listeners who haven't listened to it. I doubt that because it's one of our most popular episodes.
Even though, warning, it was one of our early ones, so it sounds a little bit less natural and a little bit less produced. This was at a time that we were still very much experimenting.
Very true, but I mean, we oftentimes talked about maybe re-recording that episode, but I think it, if anything, it shows what we were talking about 3 years ago is very relevant today because, again, we're no longer talking about the hollowing out. We're talking about just the collapse of it, right? But today, so while this episode was focused on internal institutions, today we want to talk a little bit more about the international institutions that the West has set up over the last 75, 80 years. Talking a little bit about international treaties, then we want to talk about the ICC. And at the end, we'll quickly talk about something that is kind of connected to this topic, but not directly, and that is then the symptom of Donald Trump again. But let's start with one of the kind of main treaties that I honestly, Balder, have never really thought about in my life, because to me, this seemed like a done deal. And that's the Ottawa Treaty, right? The one on banning landmines. I think we can all agree that landmines are a terrible thing, right? So because we just talked about this beforehand, right? In the 1980s, the International Red Cross estimated 24,000 people died every year because of landmines, and 80% of them civilians. Right? So landmines are these nice little bombs that you put underneath the ground, like a few centimeters, I think, underneath the earth. And if someone steps on it, they explode. And you kind of do this to, like, I think they were developed for battlefields and maybe for borders. But the problem is the moment the battle is over, people forget about them because you don't remember where you buried them. And then, let's say 2-3 years later, little children are playing on the field, stepping on a mine, and boom, at least injured, if not dead. And so there was the Ottawa Treaty that banned this, and 164 countries signed this. And why are we talking about it, and why am I saying like formerly?
Well, because they're back, unfortunately. So it's interesting, this what you're saying, that you never thought about that in your life, because this shows the generational difference. In the 1990s, certainly maybe this was spurred on by the end of the Balkans War, the collapse of former Yugoslavia, where in the late 90s and the early 2000s, we would get regular news items of, hey, exactly what you said, some children were playing in the field, and then, boom, they got killed by a landmine. It was kind of a big deal. There was this entire international campaign against it. I believe Angelina Jolie at some point campaigned against it. I know that Princess Diana, the former wife of now King Charles, was a major anti-landmine campaigner. It was one of those big social issues. To be fair, it was also one of those issues that made sense in a world that was heading towards a brilliant, peaceful 21st century, right? In the 1990s, we were all thinking that the 21st century was going to be this beautiful, liberal, democratic dream where everyone would get along, trade, and never fight with each other again. And then it was more a matter of getting landmines out of the system. Basically, the barbaric nature of the past, of history, had to be eradicated. So it was one of the things that everyone could get behind. And interestingly enough, one of the few reasons why, one of the actually only reasons why at the time the United States did not want to join the landmine treaty was because they are so heavily invested in the demilitarized zone in between North and South Korea. And there are an awful lot of landmines there. But they always said, hey, we are happy to join as long as you give an exemption for the Korean situation. And of course, then that's not how international law works, etc. So at the time, it was a very big deal. At the time, the United States was called hypocritical for not joining. Everyone was talking about it. Everyone said, this, we need to get rid of the darkness from the past, look towards a more civilized future. And now in 2025... well, people are still not talking about it, but Western countries are actually deciding to not just step out of the treaty, but actively start producing landmines again and start using them because of this nonsensical sense of threat from Moscow.
And it's not our usual suspects. Right, because based on this podcast, based on the last 3 years, you would think that the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, right? So the lapdogs of the United States, so the kind of the bad ones, right, within the West, that those would be the ones responsible. But no, the countries that are always highlighted as being the good and positive ones, right? Finland, right? The hippies of the North, they are the ones.
And here maybe I should start again with my usual public service announcement, that if you are living in a NATO country and your government is proposing to spend more on defense, you're being scammed. Use it for useful things, please. Use it for infrastructure, healthcare, education. Please, please don't buy into this narrative that your country needs to spend more on the military. You don't, you're fine. Russia is not going to invade. There is a small caveat there that if you're going to try to create scenarios where Russia would attack NATO countries, and Finland, by the way, now is a NATO country, of course, then the Baltic states, more even so than Finland, but Baltic states and Finland are the ones who are right there on that line, right? Finland, of course, has a complex history with the Soviet Union and with being threatened by the Russian Empire and with war and violence against the Russians. And with the Baltic states, there's probably the most likely kind of scenario, which is still not that likely at all. But if you're going to list, what would be the moment that Russia were to somehow take military action against a NATO country? It would be something along the lines of, hey, the three Baltic states have large Russian minorities, between 20 and 25%. we're going to claim that they're being oppressed, like what we did with Georgia and what we did with Crimea, and we're going to put troops into their territory to protect, and I'm saying protect in quotation marks, the Russian minorities. And that would be a way to annex land from them. That would be the most likely scenario in which Russia would take aggressive action against NATO countries. So it's those countries, the Baltic states and Finland, that are feeling the pressure because they have that immediate border. And then the simplistic kind of reasoning, and it's completely nonsensical when you think about it for longer than 2 seconds, but the simplistic reasoning is, oh, well, then landmines are great because we're going to put them there and then the Russians will think twice before they cross the border, right? That's kind of the thought. And the Netherlands or Canada, well, landmines won't do that much for them, obviously, right? Because the Netherlands knows that Russia is not going to invade the Netherlands. Canada, you know, they don't have a landmine issue. They would need to invest in their navy. So in that sense, you could kind of explain it away. But it still is an absolutely absurd, ridiculous decision. And what really frustrates me, what I find absolutely horrifying, but also in some ways intellectually fascinating, is that people are not bothered. People, yeah, okay, so Finland steps out of the landmine treaty. Yeah, well, whatever, they're going to produce landmines and send them to Ukraine. As if the past doesn't exist, as if we haven't learned any lessons from the past, as if we are completely ignorant, as if amnesia has struck us, as if we do not know all of these conversations and debates and discussions that were held in the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s about it.
See, if it was at least, or if it were at least my generation that was doing this, right? So let's say in 20 years, we didn't experience any of the landmine stuff, particularly not in the not in the Balkans. We were just kind of being born around that time. Okay, but no, it's not. Walter, it's your generation.
I know.
It's the people that very much should remember all of this. And that to me is scary. And then particularly, right, as you said, so it's the Baltic countries, so Finland, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, and Poland, who are kind of all withdrawing from the treaty, who want to start producing them again. And as you said, sent them to Ukraine. And I mean, Ukraine is now officially, right, the most most mined country in the world, right, where approximately 23% of the entire country is basically just scattered with mines or other explosives that explode during the war, right? And as someone who lives in a country that every week there is an evacuation in one of the cities here in Germany because we find a bomb from World War II. Right. And so sometimes it's really big over the media because it's right in the city center of Cologne or Frankfurt or wherever. Right. And then people have to be evacuated for a whole day. Right. And luckily, nothing bad has happened here in the last few years with regards to that. But so we are still struggling with the bombs that were dropped in World War II. Right. That's 80 years later. There's a lot of money still is being invested into this, right? In kind of having some of the best specialists in the world kind of taking care of this and evacuating that. And keep in mind, evacuating 500 meters, a radius of 500 meters in a city means there's, at least in Germany, means there's at least 3 hospitals, a bunch of kindergartens, schools, and so on. And it just it really messes with society then. And I mean, hey, also my personal life is affected. Just in the last 3 years, I had at least 2 trains that were completely delayed because close to train tracks they found a bomb from World War II, right? So as someone from a country that is actually affected by this, I can't understand why we now think that's a good idea. Let us drop more bombs left, right, and center because that's somehow going to make us safer and not have people in 80 years make their trains late, right? Aside from obviously all the humanitarian factors that go into this.
Yeah, there's so many variables here that don't make sense. And it starts, and I'm so sorry to be a broken record, but it's important because I feel that we're kind of fighting against this avalanche of kind of disinformation at the moment about this. It starts with the idea that NATO countries are way too obsessed with some kind of unspecified threat from Russia, because any proper scenario you know, if you're going to create a, if you're going to say Russia is a threat to us, then at least have the decency to describe what that scenario looks like, and then explain how landmines or anything else would work against that, right? So, okay, you're saying that Russia is a threat to NATO countries, that Russia might invade in the foreseeable future. Please give me the scenario. Please tell me this would be the motivations for Russia to do it, and these would be the tactics and the strategy employed with the military approaches, and then somehow landmines are going to solve that. That surely is the minimum requirement for anyone making the case for landmines in this case. Now, if you are going to think of these scenarios, of course, these countries are right on the border. So, yeah, there intuitively it makes sense to have some kind of, okay, let's, you know, a landmine means that it's harder to drive into our country, fine. But then the second issue is exactly what you discuss. Okay, so what is the price you're actually paying in the long term? First of all, let's assume that, which is a fair assumption, that Russia in the end doesn't invade. Now you've got an awful lot of landmines that cost a lot of money that probably will have gone off. There will absolutely be accidents happening. Do you really believe that this is not gonna create any victims? Do you really believe that this is not gonna create any problems at all? Then, are you sure that future generations will still remember exactly where those landmines were? Yeah, we've got it all figured out. Well, actually, I wouldn't be surprised if 20 years down the line, there will be news items of, there were some rogue military personnel put landmines in places where they shouldn't have gone, or systems collapsed and they were put in the wrong places, or anything like that. It's not gonna be that easy to solve in the long term. So you're creating a big, big problem in the short term, in the long term, for solving a non-existing problem in the short term, because the problem isn't there. Russia is not gonna invade Poland. Russia is not gonna gonna struggle with landmines because they will never step on them in the first place. Now, and then the other layer here, and that is kind of the approach of this episode, the topic of this episode, is that this is now going against international treaties. And the West has been obsessed over the past 80, 90 years with developing international treaties, with saying there's international law, we have to have a civilized global society. And now, because for the first time since, let's say, 1990, the West NATO countries feel threatened, they say, okay, now all of a sudden these treaties don't apply to us anymore because we are threatened. We have a problem and we can step out of it whenever we like. But whenever any other country in the past tried to do that, say, no, international law is for everyone. Don't you dare argue that your case is different. Landmines are bad for the future of humanity, so don't do it. So it shows the enormous hypocrisy and the collapse of Western trust in its own institutions and its own system that it's built up.
Finland, I'm disappointed in you.
To be honest, this would be an interesting case study. I'm not, of course, an expert on Finland, but it would be interesting to see how the past is still influencing Finnish thinking, right? Because they do have this violent past with the Soviet Union and Russia before that. And so it would be interesting to see to what extent they're emotionally biased in that sense. It must be quite significantly so, but it's still very, it's very sad that a country like Finland just does this and that the world doesn't seem to care. What I found fascinating about Finland is that in their statement on the government's website, they actually write, the withdrawal will not affect Finland's, the withdrawal from the landmine treaty, will not affect Finland's other obligations under international law, including international humanitarian law, which will continue to be respected. Finland will continue its support for humanitarian goals of the Ottawa Convention, as well as support for humanitarian mine action. Well, so they're basically saying, yeah, well, we're going to pick and choose. We're going to take a little bit of the Ottawa Convention and not the bit that annoys us. Then essentially you're showing exactly why international law does not work. Because if you can just do that, you can pick and choose and step away from any parts that you feel slightly uncomfortable with, then it is not international law, then it is not a proper universal structure, then it is just a series of weak, flimsy agreements that have very little practical value.
Well, as the voice of the youth here, I think it's my obligation to kind of translate this into meme terms. But it's basically the West is moving international law, right? If we're in a library, the West is currently taking all the law books and putting them into the fantasy section, right? Just on this thing. And because the next example here is the International Criminal Court, the ICC, right? Where a month ago, the United States imposed sanctions against the ICC, right? Because how dare they? The ICC is actually prosecuting Israel, and well, particularly Netanyahu and his government against their actions in Gaza, right? So where countries, just as you do with the International Criminal Court, right? Countries brought up a case against them, and then the court said, well, yeah, we think there is a case to be made, so we're going to look into this and prosecute it. And the United States said, well, you will not, because we're going to sanction at least four of the ICC justices on it. Right? That's a statement right there.
Yeah, the United States has always had a very complex relationship with the ICC. They were at the foundation of its development and its setting up. The United States were a major proponent and a major kind of actor. Again, from this late 20th century approach of we need a world order and we, the United States, are going to be the policemen. And we need some kind of system to support our policing around the world. And the Netherlands, the ICC is located in the Netherlands, could be a great place to basically position this so that it doesn't feel like an American imposition and it feels like an international thing. But then, of course, when it came to signing and ratifying, the United States didn't show up because they understood all of a sudden, especially looking at how the 1990s developed, they understood that in the 21st century, they were going to be involved in military action and that would open up the possibility of U.S. personnel being brought to The Hague. I am not making a judgment here about George W. Bush or Tony Blair or whether they would, you know, whether they're responsible or guilty of war crimes. I think that would have to go through a proper process. But given that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died after the invasion of Iraq, it wouldn't be a crazy idea to actually say George W. Bush, Tony Blair, and some top-level generals, you have to appear before the ICC. Maybe you're going to get off, but we need to investigate how this could have happened because your decisions led to hundreds of thousands of civilians dying. And of course, that was something that wasn't acceptable to the United States, and therefore the United States never actually became part of the ICC. So they've always had this very difficult relationship. On the one hand, it made sense in their liberal democratic universal structure that they were trying to create for the world. On the other hand, they didn't want to be held accountable themselves.
And to take it a step further, and this is my public service announcement that I think I've said in at least four different episodes already, but that's the American Service Members Protection Act, or informally known as the The Hague Invasion Act. Balder, how do you feel about the fact that the United States reserves the right to invade the Netherlands in case any U.S. personnel were ever to be brought in front of the ICC?
Yeah, well, as long as my family in the Netherlands are safe, I'm okay with them, whatever they need to do. No, as you know, I don't feel an awful lot of loyalty towards the Netherlands. I feel loyalty towards my friends and my family there, but not the Netherlands as a country. However, of course, it's complete insanity, right? It's especially because the ICC was in many ways an American creation. So and the Netherlands, as you said previously, is the most loyal supporter of U.S. foreign policy. So the fact that the United States is even considering this kind of thing is, of course, complete insanity. And it shows how much the United States in the 21st century has felt threatened by international institutions. In that sense, it's not a huge deviation from the norm of the past 20 years that they're imposing those sanctions on ICC judges because they've really started to dislike the whole structure around it.
Trump and his whole administration, right, is of course very critical of the ICC looking into Israel. And so in preparation for this episode, I kind of just looked at, okay, what have been some of the past ICC news items lately? And I feel like the United States and the Taliban are currently have something in common, because the right. So the ICC is also looking into Taliban leadership over their kind of ban of women's education in Afghanistan, and the Taliban basically called the ICC's arrest warrants a nonsense. And I think the United States has also called the arrest warrant of Netanyahu and some of the Israeli ministers also as nonsense, right? Funny, right, in what type of company the United States is here at the moment.
But there's a direct connection between this and what we just said about Finland. And Finland saying, hey, there's going to be a part of the Ottawa Convention that we're going to withdraw from. The other part we'll still respect. Basically, at some level, it just shows that international law was never properly gonna work, because you don't have a global authority that can say, United States, Finland, Afghanistan, you're breaking the rule, we're gonna punish you. That doesn't exist. So at some level, it just shows the idiocy, if you like, of people who pretend that international law is actual law rather than a bunch of flimsy agreements. But at another level, it also shows the complete U-turn that the West and the United States specifically has taken, that the United States and Afghanistan and Finland are all basically doing the same thing. They are saying, we are all in favor of these kinds of conventions that for some reason we call law because that's more marketing friendly. But the moment it inconveniences us, or the moment it inconveniences an ally of us, as in the case of the United States and Israel, at that moment, we are gonna reserve the right to just say, no, thank you very much, we're not gonna follow these words. But everyone else has to obviously follow it, just not us, right? Just we are free to step out of it, we're free to ignore it, we're even free to go after these institutions. But if anyone else dares to do it, then they are the bad guys. If China or Iran were to do that, or the Taliban with Afghanistan, then all of a sudden, then that shows how inherently evil they are.
Thank you so much for mentioning China, because we're recording obviously on Sunday, the 13th of July, and just yesterday, the United States issued a statement that kind of reminded everyone, right? And they basically renewed their call for China to respect the 2016 ICC decision on basically a case between the Philippines and China about the South the South China Sea, right? It's always a bit difficult when you have to call it that, right? So because in the Pacific, you have the South China Sea, south of China, huh? North of the Philippines and some other countries, and China basically claims all of the sea for itself, right? And so all of the neighboring countries, right? That's the famous nine dash line. I've basically said, no, excuse you, that's not what international law says, right? So the Philippines took China to the court, and the court ruled that, hey, China, you're wrong. And the Chinese said, yeah, we know, you know what, the United States doesn't believe you, so we don't believe you. But the United States says that, oh, when it comes to this ruling specifically against China, the ICC is absolutely spot on, and who would ever put sanctions on them? That's outlandish.
Yeah, exactly. It shows the hypocrisy, but it shows more than anything how the United States is in many ways becoming the least consistent and the least trustworthy proponent of international law compared to, for example, China, right? So not that China has been an angel when it comes to international law or anything like that, of course, but China at least is still trying to go through certain processes. The United States is much more aggressive in the way that they go about their withdrawal or threatening the ICC and trying to basically circumvent any kind of transnational process. Whereas China at least is feeling a little bit more comfortable in today's world with saying, hey, you know, the world is moving in our direction. Let's see if we can make those international organizations and that international law framework work for us. And that means that we kind of broadly have to at least pay lip service to it, right? And the United States has completely withdrawn from it. They just pick and choose. And when it is useful for them, they go aggressively after countries like China that they feel are disrespecting the agreements, or they go aggressively after the institutions themselves, which of course means that the whole system is about to collapse altogether, because without this Western driver behind it, China and India and whoever else are not going to have the power to, in the long term, basically maintain this infrastructure, right? The international infrastructure could only exist because the West was so powerful in the 1990s and they could basically impose it on the rest of the world. Now, with the West, first of all, being less powerful and secondly, being way less interested in actually supporting these processes, the future is very bleak for these kinds of conventions, as well as the United Nations and everything that was built up in the 20th century.
Now, at the end, or kind of going towards the end of this episode, we do need to talk about the symptom or the accelerator of Donald Trump again, right? So before we talked about Finland, because it's sometimes, as you said at the beginning, it's important for me to highlight that the Western bubble is not only the United States. Of course, we talk about the United States a lot because it's also the worst over there right now. It's also the most important actor. But I do want to stress that it's all of the West, right? It's the Netherlands, it's Finland, it's Estonia, it's Germany. I think the only country that we currently hold well is Spain, just because they're kind of going sometimes against the West a little bit.
I am actually very proud. Well, proud is maybe not the right word, because I've got no responsibility here. I don't work with Spanish government or whatever, but I'm very happy to live in Spain, because of all the Western countries, Spain is actually behaving the most reasonably when it comes to international affairs at the moment. Also when it comes to immigration. But their slightly weak opposition against the 5% defense norm for NATO. It's a low bar, I will admit that, but of all the countries that I see around me at the moment, Spain is probably one of the most pleasant countries when it comes to this kind of international role. And I feel comfortable living in Madrid because of that.
Yeah, if it wasn't just for the corruption within the government. But that's another thing. That's an internal thing. We'll not get involved here. But let's quickly talk about Trump. We have to. He's making it impossible for us not to. So there's two items, right, which are not kind of underlying causes of institutional decline, but which really show how well you can abuse your power. And that's Trump issuing tariffs against Brazil. And here you might think, 1 second, Brazil, isn't that one of the few countries that actually runs a trade deficit with the United States, right? So Brazil is importing more goods and products from the United States, and the United States is importing from Brazil. That was kind of the main factor for Trump and for the Liberation Day of the United States to impose tariffs on other countries. But still, he imposed a 50% tariff on Brazil. And the reason, and he publicly stated this, he's not even ashamed to admit it, is because of Brazil's unjust persecution of Jair Bolsonaro, the former, right, so the last president before Lula, who, when he lost the election, just like Trump, wouldn't admit it, and then actually started a bit of an insurrection himself. And was basically sentenced by a court, and he's not allowed to run for president for another 8 years at least. And there's another court case pending, and Trump is specifically citing this example and saying that you have to stop this, otherwise we will hit you with a 50% tariff. What a bullying behavior!
Well, in some ways, this is about the Trump administration and separate from the other issues. But one thing that it does have in common, of course, is that this shows how much the United States has fallen in terms of it wanting to respect basic international standards, right? Because in the 1990s, it would be unimaginable for George H. Bush or Bill Clinton to do anything like this, because they had this obligation to be on their best behavior, or at least try to be on their best behavior, because they understood that if they are going to impose tariffs based on some kind of personal vendetta, then the role of the United States as global leader would collapse. Now, Trump doing this in 2025 shows that the role of the United States as global leader has collapsed, right? That they don't need to pretend anymore. They don't need to uphold certain standards, because this is absolutely bullying behavior. This is like, this is mafia-esque behavior. Hey, this is what a nice shop here. It would be a shame if something happened to it. It's that kind of thing.
And the type of bullying behavior that I at least grew up with from the United States was, if anything, for opposite reasons, right? For kind of saying that, hey, you violated international law, or you didn't respect democracy or whatever, right? Any of these things. So therefore, we're going to bully you, aka put sanctions on you, right? The United States has done a complete 180 on this one.
Right, right. So in the past, it would be, and that would be the criticism if we were recording 20 years ago, our criticism would be using liberal democracy and such things as a Trojan horse to actually achieve certain other strategic or economic aims within countries, like messing around with Latin America in the 20th century, the Vietnam War, all of that. It would be international relations and liberal democracy, the end of history, being used as an excuse to basically pursue narrow specific interest. Now it's exactly the opposite. There is no ideology here. There is no sense of the United States having any responsibility towards the future of humanity. It is simply the occupant of the White House feeling kind of uncomfortable with his friend being prosecuted in Brazil, and that's it. There's nothing else to it. It's not in the interest of the American people. It's not in the interest of humanity. It's simply in the interest of Donald Trump and his little posse of friends that he feels he connects with. And it's not a very large group. I mean, it was fascinating to see how he felt uncomfortable during the NATO summit and how he was being ignored by NATO leaders, as well as the Dutch royal family, by the way. There are not many friends he has internationally, so the few friends he does have are people that he wants to protect. And he just uses his power as president of the United States not to defend US interests, but just to defend his own clique. And we can moan about Donald Trump and criticize Donald Trump, but at a slightly more broader meta level, how the mighty have fallen. What has happened to the United States that this can even happen? That the US president doesn't have to worry about protecting US interests, or doesn't have to worry about doing the right thing for US citizens, or trying to create a world in its own image. No, it's just the occupant of the White House abusing his power. It is an enormous turnaround in a very short period of time.
As you said, Trump doesn't have many friends. He has Bolsonaro, who isn't even in charge anymore. And he has Netanyahu. And here, same example, right? Netanyahu is currently facing a corruption trial in Israel. And now Trump has officially kind of called on the Israeli courts to pardon him, or to dismiss this trial, to stop basically persecuting him. Can you imagine? Let's say 50 years ago, this would have been a covert CIA mission to kind of create some regime change, yeah. Right? Where they would try to get rid of this like genocidal dictatorial person. The United States would kind of stage a coup there. No, now they're actually doing the opposite, right? Trying to keep that person in power.
And then Netanyahu walks away, nominating Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize as a tit for tat kind of lovey dovey. Kind of bromance. In the case of Israel, there's a slightly greater complexity because of the very difficult relationship that Washington generally has with this topic, right? Because there's a lot of pressure from the Israeli lobby, from AIPAC, but also from the evangelicals to continuously basically allow Netanyahu freedom to pursue this current war and this current ethnic cleansing. So there's a little bit more to it than in the case of Brazil. But yeah, again, it shows this complete collapse of any world order and the collapse of pretense of the United States. It's almost refreshing, right? And I don't mean that in a positive way, but in the past, we would criticize the United States for being hypocritical, preaching one thing and doing something else. Now they're not preaching anything anymore. They are simply using their power to settle petty scores and protect their friends and allies at a personal level, not at a statewide level. And I wonder if this is simply the result of people no longer being able to comprehend what is happening, right? We often throw, as long as I'm alive, Europeans make fun of the education system in the United States, that Americans know very little about the world on in general. They also, by the way, the United States also has the most vibrant intellectual community when it comes to international relations, the largest intellectual and scientific output. So it's sort of a tale of two cities in that sense. But, you know, there's hundreds of millions of Americans who can't point to Germany on a map, for example, right? They don't know where Germany is. That kind of thing has always been made fun of in Europe and the rest of the world when it comes to the United States. But now it's something deeper than that. It is that people, it's not only don't have the general knowledge to basically comprehend what's happening, but they also don't have the attention span. They don't have the emotional place to understand what's happening. So American citizens no longer feel that they can actually hold their leaders to account. And that creates the perfect storm for someone like Donald Trump to essentially abuse the powers that he has for his own petty scores. And it's horrifying to see. And it means that we're very clearly talking about the end of a Western era at the moment. There's no other way of putting it. The West will not be able to recover any kind of dignity out of this. It's done. We now have to think of something else because the project of the past 80 years is over. What's next?
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on institutional decline. Maybe next week we have to talk about what's next. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that you've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure you join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I could have chosen many quotes about learning lessons from the past. Those who do not understand the past will be bound to repeat the same mistakes. And there are loads of interesting quotes in that sense, specifically when it comes to countries like Finland and Poland and the Baltic states, basically completely ignoring what we know about landmines and completely ignoring the reality that they have in front of them. But I thought it would be better to go back to basics. Jody Williams was, I think she's still alive, but she was one of the main campaigners against landmines in the 1990s. And she said, "Landmines are different from other conventional weapons. When a war is over, the landmines stay in the ground and continue to kill for decades."